WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. The Trump campaign has made it clear that it will not accept the results of this election before bringing it to the court. On Wednesday, the campaign filed lawsuits in Michigan and in Pennsylvania and in Georgia, requesting more access to the certain locations where ballots are being counted. And just a couple of hours ago, a Pennsylvania judge granted the request for campaign monitors in Philadelphia. And then late this morning, the campaign announced plans to file a lawsuit in Nevada as well, a state where Republicans had already filed a suit in previous days. See a pattern? As of noon today, the AP had called Michigan for Joe Biden, with Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Nevada still undecided. In a press event in the wee hours of Wednesday morning, President Trump also brought up the idea of taking the undecided race to the Supreme Court, though experts had trouble making sense of why or how he would do that. On Twitter, Trump Inc. podcast producer Meg Kramer put the campaign's legal challenges in the context of a, quote, history of filing frivolous lawsuits, a history they explore in their latest episode alongside other major themes from their years of investigating the Trump Organization. Co-hosts Ilya Marritz and Andrew Bernstein are following the latest from the Trump campaign and administration and organization. They join me now to help make sense of the coming days, weeks, and months, and to reflect on their reporting since the podcast launch in 2018. Andrea, always nice to talk to you.
Great to talk to you too, Allison.
Ilya, so nice to see you, sort of see you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So, Andrea, one part of the last episode focuses on a man named William Consovoy, an attorney for Trump who's actually been involved in a number of election-related cases. Who is he? Why is he so important?
So William Consovoy, if people out there have heard of William Consovoy, it's probably in connection with his argument that the president could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not even be investigated by local authorities so long as he's president. He was arguing in favor of temporary absolute immunity. This is in the case where the Manhattan DA has been trying to get Trump's tax returns. And so far, Trump has basically appealed it now twice to the Supreme Court. It's now at the Supreme Court a second time, awaiting to see if they'll hear it. And in the course of that has just sort of gummed up the system. And the reason that we decided to focus on Consovoy in this series of cases, by the way, it's worth mentioning that Consovoy has also been extremely active on the efforts by the Trump campaign prior to the election to purge voter roll lists, to keep people from voting, to tighten rules on voting. And he was also the lawyer for the infamous Shelby County case, which overturned the key provision of the Voting Rights Act that essentially gutted the enforcement. The reason that we focused on him, because it was such a textbook example of how with Trump, the problem isn't individual acts of corruption. It's the way the whole system, the whole government has been corrupted under Trump to act in a certain way and sort of broken. And this series of cases about Trump's tax returns are just one example of that.
Ilya, you explained that Consovoy has mastered what you call Trump's art of litigation. What does that mean exactly?
Well, I don't know that there's an American alive who has been involved in as many lawsuits as Donald Trump. I remember USA Today tallied it up before Trump took office, and the number was, I believe, somewhere around 4,000, and it's grown while he's been in office, almost all of that civil litigation. But he is just an exceptionally litigious person, and if you listen to the way he talks about lawyers, he really sort of thinks about them as his mercenaries, his army, and the lawyers who have thrived with him are the ones who argue his case on TV and are really ferocious advocates for his view of the world, whatever, you know, whatever may come. So Rudy Giuliani, Bill Barr, Jay Sekulow, who is a radio host in addition to being an attorney, they've all played absolutely critical roles for Trump. As he managed to do in many instances in the Trump organization, as a president, Donald Trump understands that the courts may not always give you the decision that you want, but by going back to the courts again and again and again and engaging in repeated legal processes, one, you increase the chances that maybe you'll get the desired result. Two, you make it more unappetizing for other people to tussle with you. Even if we look at the issue of non-disclosure agreements, this is something Andrew and I have begun thinking about with, you know, what looks likely to be a transition coming soon. A lot of the people who've worked around Trump have non-disclosure agreements, which may conflict with their obligation to share records with the National Archives when they leave office. So there's a lot of just really unusual conflicts that are likely to arise if and when Donald Trump leaves office.
Andrew, one of the takeaways from the section on Consovoy is how much Donald Trump is willing to lose in order to win, or by winning for him means profit. How has the strategy served him?
I mean, I think it served him extremely well up to and excepting perhaps the present moment. But he's somebody that is just a master at using systems against themselves. And this sort of legal arguments is a perfect example. Here's the Manhattan DA trying to get the tax returns, going through normal procedures. And Trump knows that what are judges going to do? They're going to do what they do, which is deliberate. And it's going to take time. And meanwhile, he's going to run out the clock. And this is something, I mean, he has kept his tax returns out of any kind of scrutiny, out from under any kind of scrutiny. His banking records, he's kept records from the House. There are records in the impeachment that we have never seen because Trump basically ran out the clock. There are separate inquiries where Trump also did. And this is what Trump has been a master of, which is basically sort of managing to stay a step ahead of everybody else by, you know, getting systems gummed up. It seems to be the strategy that's playing out in real time before us, or that they're attempting to make work one more time, which is to sort of gum up the count in a series of court cases in the hopes that somehow they're going to keep votes from being counted. It looks like the resistance to that is very deep. I mean, after all, if you attack the vote, you are attacking the most fundamental institution of American democracy. It's not even a gray area. It's not even a question. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of the strategy and a lot of, you know, what we talked about with Consovoy was to try to get people from not voting in the first place. And they were successful in some areas. They were hugely successful. Consovoy filed a friend of the court brief in the Florida case that kept more than 700,000 ex-felons from voting. This was something that Floridians had decided should happen. Ex-felons should be able to vote by an overwhelming majority. I think it was close to two-thirds majority in 2018. And then there was this attempt to sort of say, well, they have to pay their fines. The result of that was some 700,000 people who, an estimated 700,000 people who couldn't vote. So when you look at the numbers in Florida and you add 700,000, you can see what a tremendous wild card is. So that is much more easy to be successful in some ways, getting people to not vote. Once people have cast votes, it's much harder to stop the counts. It's really, really hard. And even Bush v. Gore was, even though it was decided in Bush's favor, was technically in a case where Trump was ahead and preserving that count.
My guests are Andrea Bernstein.
Excuse me, I said Trump.
You meant Bush. My guest, Andrea Bernstein, and Ilya Marritz, co-host of Trump Inc. podcast. The latest episode kind of focuses on these three major themes that have emerged from the Trump administration that sort of mirror and are adjacent to the Trump organization. We just talked about litigation. You talk about conflict of interest and financial disclosure norms. Let's go into that next. Ilya, you refer to Trump's decision not to disentangle himself from his financial interests as, quote, the original sin of the Trump presidency. How do his other conflicts and sort of the businessization of the presidency stem from this?
Well, it sets an example. If the president says, I don't need to fully divest, I can run my business and have my company and do both of those things at the same time, it sends a signal to other people in government. And what we've seen is that a number of people who've served in his government not only failed to divest their businesses in a timely way, but they really didn't suffer any consequences for it. So we talk at length about Wilbur Ross. He's the Commerce Secretary. Commerce Secretary is not a position I think that a lot of Americans spend a lot of time thinking about, but it's actually quite an important position. Among other things, the Commerce Secretary is in charge of the Weather Service and labor statistics, unemployment rates, stuff like that. And this Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, has also been a lead actor in tariff negotiations with China. Well, one of the things that we've learned is that Wilbur Ross, who had a whole life in the private equity business before going into government, did not fully divest his Chinese interests before engaging in tariff talks with the Chinese. We're in a trade war, a trade war of choice that Donald Trump started with the Chinese, and his point man, Wilbur Ross, has retained actually a number of interests. I think he has now divested them, but he took his time in making those divestments. And there was a period when those interests were simply not known. Part of the problem with our public disclosure system, which, I think all of the Trump administration has really sort of illustrated some of the shortcomings in our system of government, some of the places where norms perhaps ought to be laws or laws perhaps ought to be strengthened. But one of the really interesting things is that a cabinet official like the Commerce Secretary has to disclose his financial holdings, but it only goes so far. So in many cases, it would be sufficient to say, I was a director of Acme Consulting, and you don't really get to find out what Acme Consulting LLC is and who else might own a stake in it and who their counterparties are. So we see this all through the government, and the cumulative effect of it is, in the end, to reduce Americans' ability to believe that their government is definitely acting in their interests.
Andrea, you and Ilya co-authored, you did a collaboration with New York Magazine that spun out from this latest episode. And in it, you write, the initial grifts tended to be strictly transactional on the model of the Trump organization itself, through which the Trump name could be had by nearly anyone for the right price. Later on, not money, not just money, but power became the president's currency. Andrea, how has the nature of transactions changed in the administration, and what is an example of its impact on policy?
Well, I mean, I think we saw that all through the election, that Trump, at the beginning, what we saw was sort of Trump, going to his golf courses all the time, and people could pay to be members and they could get their picture taken next to him. And then they could monetize that by essentially using the social media they created to suggest that they had very close access to the president. So that was sort of the thing that we saw at the beginning. Now what we see and have seen, saw all through the campaign, was Trump just sort of, and his appointees really, just blatantly violating the Hatch Act, which is supposed to restrict government sort of politicking by appointees. And he had his top appointees fan out all over the country to essentially campaign for him, not to mention using the White House or the Republican National Convention. So we see these ways in which Trump has used the levers of power in a way that is not necessarily going to make him money, but is going to keep him, or so he thought, in charge of power. And there are all of these systems that were, you know, built up, which were sort of norms in our democracy that people basically held to, that Trump has just broken. I mean, impeachment is another example that comes to mind, where it wasn't about making money in Ukraine. It was about using foreign policy, he thought, to help him win an election. And that really was the template for how this election played out.
And the final of the trio, the final themes that you came upon was the power of the pardon. Donald Trump has asserted he has the right to pardon himself. He tweeted, as has been stated by numerous legal scholars, "I have the absolute right to pardon," capitalize, "myself, but why would I do that when I have done nothing wrong?" What is certain and what is uncertain about how Donald Trump could use the power of the pardon?
Well, what's certain is how he's used it so far, which is extremely out of step with other presidents. Typically, American presidents of both parties have pardoned people who have shown great remorse or perhaps received an unduly harsh punishment or are doing a lot of good for society while in prison. I should say pardons and commutations. And then occasionally some of those presidents will pardon their friends and allies. If you think of Iran-Contra going way back in time, or more recently, Mark Rich, who was a donor to the Democratic Party and a friend of Bill Clinton's. With Trump, it's reversed. The preponderance of the pardons have been for friends and allies and people who help him. And it's a minority of the pardons that have been recommended by pardon attorneys. Now we turn to the potential end of the Trump administration, and legal scholars that I've talked to think it's very likely that Trump will pardon himself and pardon his friends and allies, anybody who he thinks might come in for legal jeopardy, and these pardons could be issued prophylactically. The only thing he'd have to do is say what the pardon is for it to be valid. So that would just be a completely unprecedented area of law. We don't know what a court would ultimately decide. We don't know ultimately if it's legal. That's very much debated. But given what we know about this president, you can imagine that he might try it.
Ilya Marritz and Andrew Bernstein are the co-hosts of the Trump Inc. podcast. Ilya, Andrea, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Allison, and we're still working, so we want people to keep sending tips about anything unusual to tips@trumpinkpodcast.org.